Welcome to the Elemental Awakening.
Okay, welcome everyone to another episode of the Elemental Awakening. Today I have a guest all the way from across the ocean who is tuning in at 9 p.m. his time. I think from Thailand it is. Guy Harriman, and Guy is a very interesting guy, no pun intended, is also the designer of the Ajna light, which we're going to dive into, which is a light that creates different types of experiences, I guess, visually or non-visually, and emotionally, mentally, spiritually. We'll get him to describe a bit about that, among many other interesting things that he does, which I'll get him to talk about. So Guy, welcome to the show today.
Thanks very much, Gio. It's a pleasure to talk to you and your audience. And many fun things we can talk about.
Cool. So yeah, so the way that I found Guy was I had a friend of mine who was into sound therapy come to Toronto to facilitate on these crazy tuning forks he had. And we decided to mesh that with breathworks. I'm a breathwork facilitator, and this interesting light, which I'd never seen before. And we shone it. I think shown is the right context, the light over the entire group. And some people had some really interesting experiences with the light. So maybe just give me a bit of the backstory on who is Guy and what led him to download the idea to create such a light. And we'll go from there.
Well, I'm sure you're talking about Josh Rapp.
That's right. Yeah.
Josh is a good friend. He was around a lot about maybe 5 years ago in Chiang Mai, and used to come to all my light. I do light parties every Saturday, and I've got some of his bells. I don't know the
solar bells. Yeah, I got those too.
And I have his tuning forks, three of those. We trade and stuff like that. But who I am is, I guess in my heart, I'm a monk. And in my practical life, I'm a monk now. But my journey is growing up in the UK, being sent at the age of 8 to a Jesuit boarding school, and having meeting some really powerful way showers, shall we say, even at an early age. So Stonyhurst, the public school in England, that's a 500-year-old school, you know, really long tradition. And we were doing it was a Victorian classical education, or it was being done to us. So, you know, 6 years of Latin, 3 years of Greek, and all that kind of stuff. And the Jesuits really showed me, they embodied self-discipline. And what I saw, even though there was, you know, a lot of beating and crap like that, but underneath it, there was a real purity of intention. And the Jesuits were excellent educators. So the way I survived was by reading. I went internally and read all the classics. And funnily enough, my Latin master when I was the age of 12 and 13 was Michael Tolkien. Do you know who that is?
Is that Lord of the Rings?
The younger son of J.R. Tolkien.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, he took a shine to me, basically. He let me keep my bicycle in his shed and all that kind of stuff. So the where that school was right opposite Pendle Hill, which is where the witches of Pendle were. And at the age of 13, I decided I'm going to become a witch, because I, you know, became clear that the Catholicism as it was taught was BS. But you know, we had through school orchestras, I was in the choir, you know, so there's a lot of seeds being planted. My parents were both doctors, so then when I was 18, I went to medical school. But I did the classic thing in those days, which there was a lot of acid going around at Leeds University. And, you know, the Who Live at Leeds was a couple of years before I went. And so there was some really great stuff going on. But one day the piece of blotting paper actually had some meaning. So I had 24 hours of demons coming out of doors. And it was definitely transformational. So then I dropped out of medical school and didn't know what I was going to do. I just knew I'm not going to be part of the system. And then I
You want to dive a little deeper on that experience? Because we do have a following that are into, you know, psychedelic experiences and transformations. When you say 24 hours of demons coming out, was that what most people would call a bad trip? But for you, it was like seeing things. Fine. Yeah. Tell me a bit more how that shifted you. Yeah, tell me a bit more about how that shifted you and maybe led to changing your career path.
Okay. So I'd already read Doors of Perception, Aldous Huxley, but my mother was a Jungian psychiatrist. So I grew up reading, you know, a fair bit of Jung, and over lunch table, the conversations were my father as a neuropathologist talking about the autopsies he'd done and stuff like that, and my mother talking about some of her patients. So I had, I guess, absorbed osmotically some insight into states of consciousness. And so I've always been able to be in the, you could call it dissociate, but actually observe a state while being part of the experience. So to me, although the shit was going on, you know, walk up the stairs and this thing would come out, it didn't worry me at all. It was like, oh, this is phenomenon.
Mm.
And there was no sense of fear. But what was hilarious was my father, I was staying in a house in Leeds with some other students. And my father came over randomly with my sister. And I was trying to be normal while all this stuff was going on. And knowing that it was, you know, like, but it was actually really, really a powerful deconstruction and reconstruction of the dream world of life, but not from an intellectual point of view, like, you know, reading Sartre or something like that. It was much more embodied. And so that planted some seeds. And as I say, then I went on sort of randomly, you know, being unemployed, I was looking at magazines and W.A. Smith's and Practical Electronics. I started building music synthesizers and designing them. And so I did that for a couple of years. And I was building sequences and stuff. And then I thought, oh, maybe I should go and do electronics. So I did that, went to University of Manchester. And then again, another fortuitous thing was when I graduated in 1979 was the year that InMOS started in the UK. So InMOS came out of MOS Tech and out of computer architecture, people like Tony Hoare, who designed Algol 68, he's one of the key people, but he had a new programming language or concept called CSP, Communicating Sequential Processes. So I ended up being the lead designer of a parallel processor called the transputer. Now, that is still way ahead of its time. You know, for anyone who knows Linux or Unix or anything like that, I did most of the process design. I wrote all the microcode and I did quite a lot of the layout and stuff like that. It was a small team of us, but we could do a context switch in 25 clock ticks. So
what does that mean exactly? For me, you just spoke a like different language altogether there.
Sure. When you have a process in Unix, like you're doing one task and then you move to another, it takes thousands and thousands of clock ticks to store away all the state of the one process and go to the next. So our architect, because we designed the architecture, the silicon, and the language Occam at the same time, the compiler writers were actually helping with the implementation. So it was actually a unique experience, I think.
What year was this taking place in, roughly?
This is in 1980 to the 80s, basically.
Okay.
And a lot of companies were using the transputer. So I went on a tour of the States to get feedback about the next generation. And HP Labs, IBM Yorktown Heights, you know, GDGE, all these people. And then I was in Palo Alto looking at Page Mill Road back to go to HP Labs. And I realized this is my new home, just that feeling of being at home. So then I talked to Pixar and Sega Link. So it turned out Pixar developed a 16 transputer board for the Sun workstation, was able to render Tin Toy, which is before Toy Story, in 3 months instead of 3 years. And so Jeff Mark, who designed that board, he came and worked with us in England, in Bristol. And then he introduced me to Steve Jobs. So then I ended up going to Next. And that was in 89, which I took a pay cut to do. But what I knew was that going to Silicon Valley was actually, or going to San Francisco, to be more accurate, in those days, was much more about my spiritual journey than the technology, although the technology was very interesting. So I was at Next for 4 years. It was amazing. We had the best people.
So let me ask you a question about, before we get dive into the spiritual aspect of why you found yourself in San Francisco. You know, I read a lot about the influence of psychedelics in the Silicon Valley and computer programming world. And I would just love to get your take on the type of people there. Were most of them using psychedelics and in some way, shape, or form? And how much do you think the actual use of psychedelics influenced the evolution of computers from your perspective and your experience?
Right. So the majority, and we're talking about in those days, you know, the early 90s, up to, say, 2000. There were two worlds. There were the visionaries like Steve Jobs. And, you know, he had his acid trip, same age I was, and he was actually only 6 weeks older than me. So we were both vegan. You know, there was a lot in common. His daughter went to the same Waldorf school that my daughter went to. But, you know, Steve was very private, but he was a very, very, almost, can you say, fanatically focused person, because to get stuff done rather than just to screw around takes an enormous amount of focused and disciplined work. And he was a mercurial character, but obviously very influential. The majority of people, though, in those days, they were just good engineers. You know, they were really good at math or computer science, and they had their focus was on implementation and serious academic stuff. It was before all the you know, the Facebooks and that kind of stuff, which, yes, we could talk about. This was, you know, hardcore engineering, making shit work at the bleeding edge of technology. And so again, that was a form of discipline that was really quite helpful to me. But I was, you know, I could see the writing on the wall. So I was one of the first people out of Next in 94. And I've been to about 10 startups in total, but I was at a company called Bay Networks, which was bigger than Cisco at that time. But one of my yoga students, because I started teaching yoga by then, Sudhanshu Jain, his cousin Prem Jain wanted me to come and work for him at Cisco. And so I said to him, all right, I'll come and work for you. As, you know, as a chip designer, but I want to teach yoga every lunchtime. And he said yes. So I just had this really blessed journey through Cisco. And that gave me the time, like the last 3 years I was there, I never went into the office once. I was doing this project called Toaster, which was a quad network processor developed at RTP on the East Coast. I was the only one in Silicon Valley on it, and then we were working with Toshiba in Japan. So, you know, here I am. At this stage, I was already a massage therapist. I was doing energy work. I was teaching Reiki from 1996 onwards. Had a Reiki group, you know, all this kind of stuff. So what it would happen is I also started Tibetan Qigong. So I'd do my Qigong in the morning, see my clients for massage in the afternoon, maybe teach yoga in the evening, and then do my simulations at night. So I just had, it was like a perfect transition until I got to the point where I was, you know, my guidance got stronger and stronger. So guidance was do what everyone thought was crazy, leave Cisco in 2000. All my friends said, you're crazy, this stock's doubled every year, it's gonna double next year. No, I was told you leave now. And so that forced me to sell my stock, which is the only company I ever made any money at, but it was enough. It wasn't a huge amount, but it was a good amount, and it was enough for me to bail on working for other people and working in technology. But in the meantime, in 98, I'd come to Chiang Mai to learn Thai massage. And I was doing Thai massage in the Bay Area. I even used to go into Yahoo headquarters for about 3 or 4 years and do Thai massage there. That was quite fun. But although every single person who came to see me regularly ended up leaving. I was like the death pill for the corporate world.
You would shift them. Death to the corporate world, but maybe the wake-up pill to the actual employees. So it was dual effect, you know, just split. Okay, so interesting. So you're getting to this point where you're leaving, or you have enough sort of financial stability to do what you want now. You didn't really touch so much on the spiritual transformation that happened when you went to San Francisco. Was that just getting into more of these types of modalities that allowed you to sort of tap in to that sort of aspect of yourself? Would you say that's...
Yeah, I would say so. You know, for example, in 1999, I just almost randomly was in San Francisco, and there was some sort of seminar, and I decided to go, and Terence McKenna was there.
Oh, wow.
It's the very last time Terence McKenna taught. And again, I felt something very strong in his presence. Like, I'd call it initiation. Not conscious, you know, not I'm tapping you on the head with a peacock feather, which I've had a number of those. But no, this was like, this is what I'm meant to do. And also, I went to Egypt in 1999. And Hakim, who's in the pyramid code, the whole pyramid code is dedicated to him. He was our guide. It was pretty much the last time he showed anyone around. And I had some very, very strong experiences lying in the sarcophagus. We were all turning, and I was literally falling through space. There were just stars. And only recently I've heard other people say that that happens in the sarcophagus. And that's very like an actual light journey. So, you know, something was being planted there. But really when I was done with 2002, I just come and spend half my time in Chiang Mai. Years later, I bought a house here, but you know, it's going back to San Francisco, seeing my Reiki friends doing therapy and, you know, just expecting that my life was much more about my yoga practice and my Qigong practice and all those kind of things. And I've always been really open to the joy of self-discipline, which is an oxymoron for many people who don't understand that self-love is self-discipline. Violence is discipline imposed from the outside. You know, I'm not interested, you know, basically, fuck off if you're trying to tell me what to do. Because it's not that I'm better or worse than anyone else. It's just, no, I'm on my journey and I don't bow down to psychopaths. Mm-hmm. What I learned at the age of 8 was to be well camouflaged. All right? You just don't fight. Why fight people? Because it creates more energy and feeds into the system directly. You subvert the system. Mm-hmm. Rudolf Steiner said, we transform the dragon from within. So that to me is the more powerful way. I can talk to very straight people, but you know, the things I've loved doing are Burning Man and you know, sweats and all the wonderful things. I did Wicca 101 years ago, you know, Thelema and the OTO.
Okay, yeah, I'm familiar.
Yeah, which basically comes from Aleister Crowley. But, you know, I got connected to them. So a lot of different systems were feeding in and feeding some ancient wisdom. So then in 2008, I was told to sell my house in Chiang Mai, in Sunnyvale, and move to Thailand full time.
And that brings you to where you are now. And you've been there for 12 years?
Full-time 12 years, but with the money from selling my house, I bought some land here. And my intention was just to grow some trees. And I ride on my bike from my house to the land every day and all that stuff. And then I kept on seeing that I had to build something here. And so I drew out a house on the computer and never felt right. You know, it's just like, no, this doesn't work. And I thought, where am I going to do my Qigong? And I put a bagua at the end of the house and then I deleted the house. So the octagonal bagua is where I'm talking right now.
Oh, nice.
And that's where my big crystals are that I got, you know, from Marin County, from Crystal Bill back in 99. And my musical instruments and the light parties where people come, and if they're musicians, quite a few people who come here are, then we play. And this is where, out of the blue, literally out of the blue, the download for the Ashen Light came.
So tell me a bit more about what exactly that means for people listening, like a download for a light, you know, as a computer programmer, what that means and how you convert that into an actual physical device that does these incredible things.
Okay. So this is 2013. I hadn't done any technology for like 12 years or something like that. And this Australian couple who are literally friends of friends of friends came with something called the Lucia light. You know, I looked up the Lucia light. Oh, it looks cool. Some of my friends came over and tried it. And I went on it. And I saw a lot of entoptic visions. So I knew at least it was a hypnagogic device. But the person who was running the machine left. And so I had a look at the software and said, absolute freaking disaster. I mean, unmitigated. But it was a beautiful piece of Austrian engineering. Like, the stand weighed 20 kilos and took 10 minutes to set up. You know, it's like very Bauhaus kind of thing. So they went off to a place called Dow Gardens, where Mantak Chia has his center here in Chiang Mai, on Sunday. And I was just gardening. And literally in 3 hours, I was told it's going to, I couldn't see the box, but it's a very visual thing. It's a Wi-Fi hotspot. It's a web app, which I had no idea how to do either of those. And I saw the number of LEDs, and I was told the type of LEDs, which I didn't even know existed. And I was told that it's going to be marketed, not through any marketing. It's going to be an ambassador, like a community that spreads it out organically. So, oh, okay. So it lit something very passionate in me that meant I was literally up till 3 a.m. working on this stuff, you know, learning how to do, you know, I do Perl programming. I did a lot of programming as a chip designer. But, you know, CGI, and I had to learn jQuery, and everything fell into place. I did my first ever board because I'm, you know, my background's chip design, but and literally within 3 months, I had my first prototype, and I leaned over and closed my eyes, and something very strange happened. It was not a hypnagogic effect. It was an alteration of consciousness. And so then I basically productized it 6 months and then sold the very first one to a free diver from Koh Tao. He came up to Chiang Mai and he loved it because he said it was like what he experiences in free diving. And then I've worked totally on my own. You know, I don't have staff, I don't have anything. It's just like I do all the ordering, I do all the board design, I do all the software, I do the shipping. You know, I have one person who helps me answer questions for people. He's a monk from, an ex-monk from Australia who now lives in Thailand, who's a sound therapist, a really wonderful person called Prantikin. But, you know, he knew he was coming to Thailand to help me with this. But apart from that, it's just me doing it. And my way of doing it is I create an organic feel about it, like the videos and whatever. And the Facebook group, which is a community Facebook group, which I don't, you know, it's not like me posting. I'm one of the lesser posters, but it's for people to connect. And then we gather stories. We gather our mythology, if you like, of the light. And in doing that, the souls, and it's nearly always young people, as you can imagine, which is wonderful for me because people with a more neuroplastic mentality and an open heart are the ones who see and become the future. And I've always loved change, you know, love to reinvent what I'm doing. Whether it's music or anything. Yeah, I'm going to continue learning and growing until my clock runs out. So anyway, that's how it happened. And my thing is, I always follow the guidance I get. And there's a difference between egoic projection, that you know, there's an agenda here, and something that purely comes through the heart, that's in the wisdom stream. So I think the last really, really major life-changing thing for me was that my Brahmacharya partner, she's a Thai Buddhist. She took me to her wat, and in the wat, the abbot Lumpur Sichin, the first time he saw me, I had long hair. I hadn't got my hair for 16 years. I was doing the yogi, vegan yogi thing, and he said, you have to shave your head. You have many lives, past lives as a monk. Okay. But it, you know, sort of felt in harmony. And then I started seeing some of my past lives in India, Tibet, Thailand, and China. Some of them were really, really clear. Like in China, there's the wall of an old temple, and it has, you know, whitewashed walls, and then the tiles on top of the walls. And I was walking with a horse leading a cart with wooden wheels, you know, solid wooden wheels. That was a pretty long time ago. But that kind of thing became more and more clear. And then, you know, I think I should probably, well, the day after I finished building the healing center, it was my birthday, we went to the Wat, and Sichin said, now's your time to become a monk. So, no, I want to go back. And he said, okay, you can leave. But the last two people I told they had spiritual work to do here, left were in serious car accidents on the way back to Chiang Mai.
Wow.
And I knew he wasn't threatening me. It was just like, no, this is the way it is. In Thai, it's called the Sam Lot. The three worlds are at that Wat. And I'm literally the only foreigner who's been ordained there. But the Sam Law is the Golden Cave, which is a very beautiful place, and the Japanese sala built by some Japanese Buddhists, which is beautiful. But the main place, I used to try and sleep there. It was like, no, I couldn't sleep. It was just like hardcore. You know, it's a lower world, yeah.
Yeah.
So then I had to learn, I spent a month there, I had to learn Pali to be ordained. And there are some really funny stories about that. Like, you know, there are 10 things you have to answer in Pali, yes or no to. And because I was the oldest one becoming ordained, and I sponsored some other hill tribe men who want to become, you know, so it's like I put the money into to do the thing. But my favorite question of all, and it's a serious question, is, are you human? Because the thing I love about Thailand, north of Thailand in particular, it's an animistic culture still. And so they understand about ghosts. You know, the Rayasis, like the Roshis in India, and they're also called Roshis or something in Korea. There are 20,000 of them. They all came from the Altai Mountains, so they were the real shamans. They went to Japan, and you know, they built the polygonal stone buildings and had beards in Japan that you can see on them. So that culture spread all the way through, and now the monks have always done quite a lot of magic, and the Rayasis. Part of my yoga is called Rayasi Dadon, which is some particular exercises Rayasi taught me. But they do black stuff too, which is like not my thing at all. But anyway, the you know, living with the consciousness of, say, the Jyoti. The Jyoti is the spirit owner of the land. And this land, one day I was told, you know, we were trying to find land, and this man said, I can show you five places. And first place, no, second place, definitely not, third place, no. And I knew in the third place, the fourth place would be it, even before I came. And it was just weeds. When I came around the corner, I could feel something. And so this was the land. And I bought it on 888, you know, 8th of August, 2008. And the price for the land was 444. I offered that, which is less than some other people were offering. But the owner, I said, look, I'm doing Qigong, I'm going to take care of this land. And he sold it me because he knew that this was the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, 444 is a special number for me too. It really has a lot of significance. It pops up a lot, and I see the excellent numbers too. So interesting.
Yeah, I'm a big numbers person. Yeah, huge numbers person. So anyway, the Jyoti, I've seen him once walking through the healing center, and the nuns, they're called Meshis. The nuns who come here, a lot of them are psychic. You know, they basically they go and live in the what because they're very sensitive empaths, and they do readings for people and stuff like that. But many of them came and saw him, and one man, he was just parked outside. He was a driver, and he was waiting for the person in here. And he said, as he was asleep, somebody came and put their hand on his chest. And he described the same person I saw. Long orange robes, like Sai Baba, and long black hair. So the Indians came to Chiang Mai. There's actually quite a following of Ganesh, even in Buddhism. Mm-hmm. So anyway, magic to me is connecting with the implicate order, the information that is within the proton.
Okay.
And in other words, the proton, the shell of the proton is the looking glass. So Alice through the looking glass is going into from the explicate world to the implicate world. And nowadays in my practice, quite a lot of stuff is coming up about how that's organized and translating the complete nonsense of mathematicians pretending to do physics when they don't know anything about the real world, don't know electronics, and building these models of, you know, virtual photons. And I even saw some idiot write a magnetic particle. So,
I'm not sure what that means. That's beyond my sort of knowledge. It doesn't mean anything. Okay. So.
It means the opposite of what can exist in the universe.
What can exist?
But, you know, okay. Sort of, but anyway.
So yeah, I'd like to ask a bit about, so all of these experiences you've had, they seem like they're leading you down this path and these different things and using your intuition and just following that guide within. And it's brought you through many different experiences, whether it's computer, psychedelics, Silicon Valley, all the way to more of a spiritual awakening or path, you know, that's led you to where you are now. And I would say from your philosophy, like, what is your insight on, you know, your purpose of this life, like, why are we here? Or why do you feel that you're here in this journey that you talked about? Like, what is there a destination or is it an evolution that you're experiencing? And is there something collectively happening right now, you know, around the world in these times or during COVID that, you know, makes sense to you, or maybe some of the spiritual teachers that you have a way to explain it? So I'd say first start with the personal as to where you see you're going and if there's any insights you have on the collective of what's going on right now.
Well, when I was learning, becoming certified as a yoga teacher in yoga therapy, non-duality in Advaita Vedanta was a big part of it. Joseph LePage was really, he was the person teaching, he was very focused on that. And it didn't make sense to me intellectually, but in my heart it made sense. So unraveling, I would say the purpose of life is to prepare for the bardo of death. In other words, to go from the non-dual dielectric stillness of the void, which is the Akasha, where everything is, all the energy. I mean, you can call it dark energy if you really want. It doesn't make any sense as a term, but that unity opens through Planck's doorway, which is the doorway of awareness, into the electromagnetic dantians of consciousness. So we go from dielectric, which is capacitive effect, you know, field, which is pure potential energy. And as you move the capacitor plates close together, the same voltage across them, you get more and more and more energy stored there. And so I'm actually working very consciously on sleep yoga and dream yoga. I have a lot of interest in Dzogchen, which is the non-dual Huang Tibetan teaching. And I have a beautiful tonka that I've been working with from Bhutan, which is properly blessed and everything.
And tell me about the dream yoga. So is that like lucid dreaming or being able to awaken inside your dream to get deeper understanding or different experiences? How would you describe that in layman's terms, what the essence of the practice is?
So the beginning of lucid dreaming, because I've been doing lucid dreaming every day for about 25 years now. I just decided this is something that's important to do. And it's just what you said. There are certain practices, like breathing practices and visualizations, to connect to what they call Rigpa, which is the stillness in the heart. And to be in the clear light mind all the time. So sleep yoga is more focusing on staying in the clear light mind awareness, even in the deepest part of sleep. So there's a luminosity quality to the deepest part of sleep. And then the dream yoga is more about it's something I'm still in the process of. It's obviously going to be a never-ending thing. But how I put it is, using the imagination while you're in the dream. And one of the key points in dream yoga is that the waking world is a dream, like the nighttime world is a dream. And it's sort of, okay, intellectualist. But I actually realize what they're talking about. The mechanism in the thalamus and in the cortical region of the brain is one of prediction and conceptualization and pattern matching, basically. So that same mechanism is used at night and during the night and during the day. So the only difference is the thalamus is a switch, thalamocortical cortical region, it's a switch. So when your melatonin is high, or when you're under the Ajna light, your switched sound and light is switched from the conscious mind, in other words, the cortex is switched off, and it's switched to the inner world, which many people say arises from the pineal, but it's actually more complex than that. So that mechanism, the same mechanism of predictive decoding of the world or phenomena, or as they say, you know, you've got a brain in the dark box and it's trying to figure out what's going on and doing the lowest metabolic matching to get the most beneficial prediction, where beneficial generally means beneficial to the ego, so, which is not a good, not the end game. Being able to be aware that in samsara, in the day-to-day world of reactivity, the same phenomena are going on as are in your dreams. And the dream yoga, they talk about three types of dreams. There's the karmic dreams, which in other words, they're due to karmic traces of actions that you have done or other people have done around you that are coming up for clearing. And then non-karmic ones, which are basically in the lower dantian, the gut brain doing its thing.
Dantian are energy centers, correct? As far as like the translation dantian.
Three energy centers. And the third type is they're called dreams of clarity, which are where the teachings come. So for example, when I was coding the Ajna light and I couldn't fix something before in the morning, I'd just give up. It's like, I can't fix this bug. Gecko says yes. Did you hear him? Gecko.
I heard something, yeah.
Yeah, that's the gecko. He's my psychic guy. But anyway, I'd wake up in the morning doing my practice. I said, oh, that's the answer. So
karma, you said, then there was karma, the clarity. So the karma's coming out in your dreams of past things that need to be processed, of things of past lives or whatever. Then the third, even this life. Okay. The second one was?
Just the non-karmic, in other words, bodily related experiences. But what I'm getting is something which I think will tie back to the main topic here. I call it the intra-enteric mycelium network. So, you know, we have 200 billion neurons in the gut with the dendritic cells sampling the interior, touching the interior outside world. And psilocybin and psilocin act as interfaces to nature. So all the ways we perceive beauty, which are non-intellectual ways of perceiving beauty, you know, the feeling beauty, come from that nature interface. And it's to do with coupling of complex organic systems. It's a fractal system. And I believe our internal mycelium network is what gives us that. So when I say non-karmic dreams, it's stuff that's coming up that maybe some people might refer to as nightmares, or because they're trying to impose meaning, because they're so locked into their conditioning, onto this energy to come up. So if you like, that's the demonic realm, the daemon. And daemon, you know, D-A-E-M-O-N, has a very different meaning in Greek. You know, it's a sort of, I see it as elemental and umbilicus, psychic umbilicus, to Mother Nature, who's still feeding us.
Yeah, our studio is called Elemental in Toronto, their float studio.
Okay, well, there you are. So I work with the elementals a lot. So anyway, that's the purpose. But the idea is that actually in sleep yoga, you go through three bardos every night. First bardo is at 11 p.m. when the meridian clock, you're moving into gallbladder. So gallbladder is the time for digestion of nutrients through the bile and the small intestine. Secondly, you get the glymphatic system drainage, so you have all the drainage. And then you have detoxification from drainage. So that is, I call it yin pitta. It's the yin side of the fire. So you go through that bardo, and then at 3 a.m. when what I call plasma dawn happens, which is, you know, the peak time to get up if you like, want to meditate early in the morning. Plasma from the sun, its dawn is at 3 a.m. And then you're moving, so you move through gallbladder, liver, then you're moving into lung time. Well, lungs are where DMT is generated. And you're moving from delta in that unconscious phase of sleep, deep sleep, into theta, into REM sleep. And so the lungs are about releasing emotions and through the karmic thing. So you can see how the meridians play into this. And then 5 a.m. you move into the large intestine, and that's where this information is coming through from nature, through the microbiota, and they generate, you know, 90% of your serotonin, endorphins, hormones. So the gut is extremely important for generating joy.
Okay.
Joy cannot be intellectualized or grasped. Happiness can be grasped 5 minutes, but you know, when it's a dopamine hit, an addictive process, so it becomes less and less rewarding. But joy, I feel joy every day at the end of my practice because I'm working with these centers and really feeling them. So they say at that point you've gone into it's called Vajrakaya, Vajrakaya Kosha. So the first one is, it's not a kosha when you're in the deep sleep, but this is the perception body. And they say that when you go through death, the second bardo is you become aware in death. You get a perception body. And then at 7 a.m. is when the end of the large intestine time, that's time to wake. That is the bardo of awakening or rebirth. So every night you get an opportunity to practice.
And after each practice, so I guess like over time, the goal would be what? Just releasing a lot of the things that are blocking sort of your evolution and just processing energy that needs to move through you and growing as I guess a soul or your true self rather than, you know, things that are in this physical reality. Like how would you sort of explain in layman terms the process of this practice and what it would do for someone? You know, if you had to sum it up, what, how would you sort of describe that?
So the symbolism, in Dzogchen is the rainbow light body. You're creating a resonant, coherent, crystalline form. And it's all the crap, which is conditioning from society, from your family, from your culture. That's there for a good reason, fine. But it's there to work through. If you wish to achieve peace and harmony in your heart.
And I think that sums up almost every spiritual journey, right? Like in a nutshell, I think you just nailed it. Like all this stuff is here for good reason, but the process is to work through it, to create this clear vessel that is no longer affected by all of those things. Sorry, keep going. Yeah, I love the way you phrased that.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's the key that as far as I can see.
And there are many paths there too, right? Like dream yoga is one that may be very effective and resonates with you, but there are other similar ways to do a similar process. Yeah.
You can do it playing golf.
Okay.
I mean, literally anything that takes you into a transcendent state where you're still grounded. So if you go from, you know, the normal associated beta waveform, you know, brainwave, egoic controlling kind of consciousness, which is what society wants, because that makes you very manipulable, into not a dissociated state, which is where you're all over the place, you can't do anything, you can't tie your shoelaces, you're a flake, you know, all that kind of crap. That's on the opposite side of disintegration.
Integration
is harmonizing the detritus as well as the angelic influences that we have within us and without of us. So we have...
It's interesting. I feel inspired now that I bought this book on dream yoga. I read it in another book and it's been sitting there. I read the first chapter, said, okay, I got to come back to this at the right time. And now I feel like this conversation, I had no idea we were even going to get into this. I thought we were going to talk more about, you know, lights and other cool things. And I was like, okay, like for me, like you said, when you sort of had certain things, there's a guide that said, okay, like, hey, this has come up a couple times now. Maybe it's time to sort of dive in a little deeper and see what comes up.
That's exactly right, Gio, and I encourage you to do that. I wait with things for a very long time until it's exactly right. In fact, you know, I used to read so much as a child, and then part of my journey was having a lot of difficulties with sight because I must have some very deep program. Probably, you know, I've seen myself burnt as at the stake as a witch and that kind of thing. It's very graphic when I tune into that. And so something in me said, you can't have inner vision at the same time as outer vision. So I ended up, when I stopped working, almost immediately, I got two cataracts. Oh. And I ended up building this healing center almost blind. I mean, I literally could see this place. I couldn't travel anywhere. I could only travel to airports where I knew where everything was. But I was doing natural vision healing. So I want to see, okay, this is part of my journey. And after I was ordained, I decided, okay, my worst cataract, I'll have surgically removed. Because even 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, the Buddhists were doing cataract surgery with a gold needle. Very interesting. Oh. It's one of the things that, no matter how strong your mind is, and I tried all the drops and blah, 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 and all practices, it seemed to be pretty much impossible to get rid of the glycation on the lens. But anyway, it's turned out, because I've been doing the Bates method every day for like 20 years now, that my vision is getting better and better and better and better. And so I wore glasses from the age of 8. So I still have some clouding in this eye because of all the damage from the surgery, but I'm now able to read finally, relatively comfortably. And so that literally, I think the second book I read was this book on dream yoga. And then another book on dream yoga and sleep yoga. And so it's just come up. And I think, you know, the journey to a graceful death is the most beautiful affirmation of the transcendence of disconnection. So the ego runs obviously in fear, but it's fear of separation from unity. And when society's going through a cataclysm, which we are right now, there are two things possible. One is reaction and destruction, and the other is doing inner work and inner construction. So you can be part of the external destruction which I think is very healthy for nature. Nature works, you know, it's just Shiva. When something has gone too out of balance, it's time to harmonize it.
Destroy it, bring it back.
Well, it destroys, it ends up destroying itself. That's the irony, you know. Mm-hmm. You can't have any better agents of terrorist financial destruction than the central banks of the world. They're doing excellent work. But on the other hand, you have crypto.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, what a beautiful thing. And I was actually, I knew about crypto in 2009 because my daughter's boyfriend and we were talking in Berkeley because she went to UC Berkeley. We were sitting in the car and just talking. He was in open software and he was saying, there's this thing called Bitcoin. And I said, oh, it sounds really interesting. But I waited and because I knew, you know, they're going to try and kill it. And then I started buying in early 2017. So, you know, we have the seeds of grassroots revival. And now what's hilarious is all the big corporations are beginning to FOMO in to Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. So,
so interesting. Yeah.
You know, it's like you only need a tiny bit. Tiny bit. As insurance.
Yeah, so what would you say then to people right now who are going through this process, maybe awakening for the first time, realizing the chaos that's going on? You know, I think you sort of gave the two things. One is, you know, the fear can gobble you up or the inner work. So what would you suggest to people? Like if you had to sort of say something to them to, I don't know if reassuring is the good word, but maybe advice or what you would say, like people right now, what's a message you would have for them?
Well, I'd first of all put my hands on my heart and feel that, because that's our true essence. And then I would say, peace arises from understanding your true nature. Confidence comes from peace. And surfing is working with the waves, you know, the waves of disturbance. But when you surf in the heart, and it's an embodied experience, you see the noise and the fear. And so the way to do that is to allocate your time with love. So for me, you know, it's love, time, and money. Most people give all their time away to make money. Love is clearly the only thing of any meaning. You know, our time can come and go whenever it is, but time is our real currency. Time is the flow of time, the current of time. So being judicious about your expenditure of your time and allocating an abundance of time to contemplation will allow you to go back to love. And doing some fairly simple things, like particularly being frugal and simplifying your life and cutting out circumstances and people who are draining you and want to entrain you back into the group consciousness, which is samsara, the hell consciousness, you have choice, and choice is sovereign. So the whole Covidius experience is the first time nature's been able to breathe for like 30 years. A friend of mine in the UK, I've known him for about 45 years. We haven't spoken for ages, but he said he lives outside London. And he said, the air there is really good. But he said, when the lockdown happened, the air was beautifully pristine, clear. And same here in Chiang Mai, you know, Delhi was clear for the first time ever. So nature being able to breathe and us learning that frugality is a key moral action. So I've always been really, really frugal. You know, I saved my threepenny pieces as a boy, put them in the post office. and I have, my only vehicle is a bicycle. You know, it's just that my, I eat once a day. You know, I'm vegan, raw vegan. So it's like my needs are nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I get much more joy from that simple life.
And I think that sort of mindset, especially in the consumer world, you know, you realize you need very little to survive and to thrive. It takes away a lot of fears of losing money and job and this and that, all these things. It's more like there's probably more mental sort of things you're holding on to than the physical because of the fear associated with this need for things. And right. When people start to realize, like, hey, if you had nothing, you'd probably feel a lot better, but realize, like, hey, like, you can't take anything away from me because I don't need much, or I can't lose anything because I don't need much. And then, you know, the other things start to become more evident, which, like you mentioned, like the joy, you know, the love, which is probably, you know, and the time, which are the currency and sort of the I wouldn't say end goal, but the state of being that you want to be in, that most people are searching for, and they think all these other things are going to get them there, like stuff and the money and the prestige of being, you know, like whatever you want to title yourself. So I think that's a really good way to sort of sum up this conversation here, and it sort of came full circle since we started. So I guess just an ending or ending off, do you have any presence on social media? Is there any way you'd want people to get in touch with you or find the Ajnalites? Is there anything you want to share as a point of contact moving forward here, or some last words you want to share?
Yeah. So there's a Facebook group. We have close to 4,000 people now. It's called the Ajnalite Community Facebook group. And I do live videos every Saturday just for fun. You know, talk about some of the wacky stuff I do. You know, I was in Vancouver for the Plant Spirit Medicine with the Light in last November. And I'm just talking to Mark, who runs that, sponsoring for this year for their virtual thing. And Paul Stamets did a talk with them today, and he's going to do a talk in the virtual thing, and he's a real hero of mine.
Absolutely.
Very, very sensible person. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one way of thinking about it, what you just said, I like to use biology as it's more than a metaphor. There's a reality to the way the body works with emotions. So fear is in the kidneys. And if you put your kidneys together, they would form a brain. You think about it, the shape is very similar, right? And so you've got the intellectualization of separation. It's an ideational construct that triggers the kidneys to embody the fear. But midway in between is the heart. And that's why I say the very simplest thing you can do in the morning when you get up is go and look in the mirror and put your hands on the heart, on your heart, and give love to the person you see in the mirror.
Mm. Amazing. Beautiful.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Gio. You know, I was told at the end of last year that I had 7 years of inner work to do, and that was before the whole COVIDius out. Coming. And so for me, I was really prepared for it. And I see very few people. Like the DHL man came today. But, you know, often I'll go 2 or 3 days without seeing someone, like, you know. And it's not that I'm a recluse, but I know that this process, the daily practice and doing the dream yoga and all the practices, whatever makes sense to you, to create the most beautiful crystalline coherent form of yourself, achieves resonance of your soul for Gaia.
Mm.
And all of us are doing it in our own way. That's why I say somebody playing golf with that consciousness, good for them, you know, beautiful. Love it.
Yeah. That resonates right through me. I feel it as you say it. I also share a similar message whenever I teach a breathwork class or meditation. It's a guy's, you know, as you work on yourself, have no expectation of trying to change anyone else. The more you change yourself, you move the needle on the globe. There's an energy frequency and we're all pushing it slowly, one little tick at a time. And, you know, and maybe in a lingo that you say, what was that thing in 3 years that Pixar did in 3 months? The process and ticks.
The parallel. Yeah.
So that's what we're doing now. We got to think of it as now our processor is coming online as many of these sort of nodes that are tapping in. And what may have taken transformation 10 years, the more of us that are doing this work now is going to create this processor. It's going to have a higher processing speed in order to sort of process this collective karma or whatever it is we are going through collectively. And so that's what just came up right now. It's just like, work, focus on yourself, plug yourself in, you know, create that clear crystalline rainbow crystal structure within yourself. And I'm a strong believer that, you know, we're going through something we need to go through. And on the other side is bliss and joy in this life or the next, however we want to define that. But and I want to sincerely thank you for taking the time to spend here. I know it's late for you, and I really appreciate you and the work you're doing. So keep it up, and I'd love to keep in touch in one way or another. And you know, my goal is one day to make it out to Thailand. I've always wanted to go there and bring the family. So maybe one day I'll pop in and surprise you with a visit or something. So
that would be wonderful, Jim. Yeah. Thank you very much, and I really appreciate you taking time, not knowing me, but you know.
I just felt the resonance when I saw your pictures. Like, okay, I need to speak to Guy. You know, he's someone that I'd love to have a conversation with. So, everyone tuned in, guys, check out the Angelite. Check out Guy's work in the Facebook group, and thank you for all the support, following the shares, and all the such. So, thank you, and we'll see you guys soon. Thank you.
Okay, take care.